Of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
They think they're living in a police state.
Once upon a time, there were these people in Europe called pilgrims, and they were afraid of being persecuted. So they all got in a boat and sailed to the New World where they wouldn't have to be scared ever again.
I loves my gun,
and I don't mean no money like I work at Walmart and make no money.
So enjoy yourself, or I'll come looking for you. There and veg out in front of your TV and enjoy what these fine people are giving you, which is maximum entertainment. You understand what I'm saying about? And don't you ever, ever, ever forget what it's like without TV. Because before TV, people just sat and played with themselves all night.
I loves my gun. Loves my gun.
Recorded the 16th of May, 2012. Welcome back to another episode of Rangers A to Z. This is your host, Iron Angel. I want to thank you for tuning in and listening, and hopefully we'll have some fun stuff for you this time. Today's episode is Camping Cookout. So we've had a few episodes of just kind of telling stories and goofing around, that kind of stuff, so it's time to get back to practical solutions for everyday problems, which is really the focus of this show. Hopefully you got a few laughs out of the other stuff. Hopefully you'll find something useful in this one. As usual, you can find us at r4nger5.com, that's rangers.com, or if you're Facebook inclined, you can find us at www.facebook.com/r4nger5.a2z, A, the letter, the number 2, the letter Z. With that, let's get into what we're doing. A lot of the stuff we've talked about so far has been basic everyday, tips on getting through minor difficulties. Things like, getting snowed in or things like that. Let's get into a little bit more advanced stuff. One of the things that a lot of people kind of overlook when they're camping is food. They always end up throwing hot dogs or hamburgers or something like that on the grill and call it good. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but there's no reason in having to eat horribly or eat quick and dirty food, that kind of stuff, when you actually have a lot more skill and ability available with just a little bit of study. Now, like anything else, I strongly suggest you do some research, check your sources, definitely, as with always on this show, check your sources against what I say, because I might have forgotten something really important. I might have very different taste than you do, that kind of thing. So definitely go through and cross-check your sources. The usual disclaimer stuff. You're going to be cooking with fire, so you're potentially going to injure yourself. That's not my fault. You got to use the safety tools you have, and that's your brain. So at any rate, we camp a lot, and for a while we did the usual everyday, North American camp food, and then we decided, you know what, there's more to life than this. Tasty, tasty orange juice. One of the things that we started doing a long time ago, I think this probably started in the Boy Scouts, but I can't remember for sure, is kind of a hobo packet sort of deal. This is really simple, and you can do this in a grill. You can do it in a gas grill, a charcoal grill. You can dig a pit in the ground and build a wood fire and let it cook down to just coals. In almost every case, when you're cooking over a campfire, you're not actually cooking over open flame. You get a lot more even heat and a lot better heat off from coals. So if you've got a campfire lit and you're looking to do some cooking, that kind of stuff, rake the bed of coals off to the side to cook on, and stack up some more firewood in the center for your light and heat and that sort of stuff. By cooking over coals, one, you don't get anywhere near as much soot on your cooking utensils, like your pans and so on and so forth. Two, you don't have that oxidizing flame wrapping up around your food and carrying soot up into your food. A lot of people that we camp with have a tendency to always default to stew. And while it works, it gets boring after a while. It's the same thing over and over and over again. You know, when you've had stew for the 15th time on the 15th campout, you know, you start to think, okay, we can do more than this. And you really can. If you know what you're doing, you can seriously bake a cake on coals. You'll need a good cast iron set of cookware to do it. And there's certainly some monetary outlay, but if you go to yard sales and things like that, you can often find cast iron pretty inexpensively. And we'll come back to seasoning cast iron here in just a little bit. This first little thing, the little packets are actually done with aluminum foil. All you really need is some vegetables, meat if you want it. It works better with ice. It can be done with water, but it works better with a couple of cubes of ice. So if you've got a cooler with you for beverages, what you're going to end up doing is taking your materials, your foodstuffs, dicing them up fairly small. Let's say for example you're using carrots, you're going to use some potatoes, some onion, you know, what have you, whatever your taste runs to. But you're going to put all this stuff into about a foot square, or a third of a meter square for you folks in the UK, chunk of foil. Basically, you know, run your foil out and tear off a square, and lay all the stuff in there. We usually put a pat of butter in there, about a half a tablespoon of butter in there, and an ice cube. And what the ice cube is there for is to create steam. It seems to work better to use an ice cube than it does to use water, because you can get a more controlled measurement. And in some cases, if we've got something that we really want to steam good, we put in a couple ice cubes. Probably what happens is the ice cube lasts a little longer, too. When you get everything in the package, you just basically crease the foil up around it and make a little folded, seamed packet. And lay it right straight on top of the coals. You don't have to cover it with anything. You don't have to put any more coals on top of it. And after 20 minutes to a half an hour, you'll pull one of these packets out and poke the stuff in it with a fork. If you've got potatoes in there, they're a really good example. If you poke a potato with a fork and it goes all the way through and crumbles, breaks in half, that kind of stuff, you're good to go. If it's hard still, it needs to be cooked more. Raw potatoes, that sort of stuff, just not that much fun. So you'll have to experiment with this. The best way to do this is to try it out at home and keep a little notepad of what you used, how much you used. You don't have to weigh it, just guess. You know, a cup of, say, carrots, a cup of potatoes, so on and so forth. But it gives you a rough idea. How much butter did I use? How many ice cubes did I use? How long was it in? And having a little kind of journal like that gives you a reference to go back on later and say, okay, this worked really good this way. Let's add this food to it. Let's add that food to it and see what happens. Now, of course, if you're cooking any kind of meat, you probably want to cook the meat a little longer. You might want to cook the meat first. People are going to be freaked out by this, but you can do this without any difficulty whatsoever. You can take something like a cut of beef or a cut of pork and lay it right straight on the coals. Yes, you're going to get some ash on it, but it's not a real big deal. What ends up happening is you get immediate searing, which closes the meat up and hopefully reduces the flare-up quite a bit. In a gas grill in particular, you'll see flare-up as the fat boils out of the meat. And that flare-up will give you some sootiness and some things like that, and tend to char things a little. By putting it right directly on the coals will wick the fat out of it, and you don't have the flare-up anywhere near as bad. And you will have some flare-up still occasionally. If you've got something like, say, a cast iron pan lid, you can set that right over the top of it, and that'll help reduce the flare-ups quite a bit because it reduces the oxygen in there quite a bit. The surface of the meat will tend to be more charred. That's the only real issue with a lot of this kind of stuff. It gives you that really tasty kind of a almost a coating. And one of the tricks there is to use that to your advantage. When you're done cooking it, you take it out and brush it a little bit, and the ash comes right off it. Then you just cube that up and add that into your packet, and then go ahead and cook as per normal. by pre-cooking your meat somewhat, you don't have to worry about, you know, like raw chicken, for example, contaminating your food and causing problems. And obviously, you really want to get your meat up over 165 degrees, no matter how you're cooking it or what you're cooking it in. Just simply because that's the considered safe point. You don't want to get it too dry, which is why we add the ice cubes and water and such to the packages. And a little bit of butter or oil in there will help to make everything kind of fry just a little bit, give that little bit of a grilled crispness to it. You can use olive oil, you can use canola oil, you can use other vegetable oils as well, saffron oil, things like that. But definitely experiment at home first before you try and do this out in the field. Now, when you've got this packet done, it's going to be hot. You're going to need some method to get it back out of the fire without torching the crap out of yourself. A decent set of fireplace tongs or something like that will work, or grill tongs will work to grab it, pick it up, set it on a plate. Leave it set for about 5 minutes, let the carryover heat push into it a little more, and level out the temperature some so that when you open it, you don't get hit by a blast of steam. You might even want to stab it with a fork a couple of times and give it a vent to let it vent out some of that steam that's still going to be in there. And you can, you can open it, but you are risking getting steam burned, which is just really not a whole lot of fun, especially when you're camping. You know, you're out trying to do this, that, and the other thing. You're out trying to swim or whatever, and you got a big old steam burn on the side of your arm. That just sucks. So don't do that. Let's see. What other things? Oh, corn works that way if you want to. You'll have a tendency to get the corn a little bit charred on the edges that are closest to the heat. So, you know, laying it in a bath of butter and water helps quite a bit to prevent the charring so much. But it does caramelize really nicely. That slightly charred, kind of a golden brown, slightly orange tawny color is actually very sweet caramelized sugar from the corn itself. And that can be real tasty. Now, something you need to be aware of is the spices you normally use at home in a normal kitchen setting may or may not work with the fire as much. This is why you want to experiment. And when you do things, particularly if you're trying to figure this out and get it really down pat, the best way to do it is to only change one thing at a time. So if you've got a system that works, you've got these packets figured out and they work really well, start experimenting with spices. Change a spice at a time. If you like a little bit of a spicy kick, Creole or Cajun seasoning is a pretty good spice to add that works really well with this. The Southern Blacken-style seasonings work extremely well with things like fish, chicken, pork. But oddly enough, they also work pretty well on corn. It won't fully blacken on corn, but it will typically give you a really interesting flavor if you like that Southern-style flavor. Now, if you don't so much like the Southern-style flavor, a little bit of salt, perhaps some pepper. Depending on what the weather's doing, you may want to have different spices as well. For your camping spice kit, I strongly suggest putting your spices in some sort of watertight containers. Little plastic sealable containers is not a bad choice. The main reason for that is basically if you get them wet, they're going to clump up. They're not going to work real well. They might go bad on you. Over time, they certainly will. But it's not real hard to go down to the dollar store and find some inexpensive plastic containers. And you might even make up your own spice mix. Say you like a little touch of garlic, a little touch of onion powder, some Creole seasoning, things like that. Mix up your spice in advance and have it all in one container so you can add it directly to your foodstuffs. Now, as you start to cook for more people, that gets a little trickier. Some people won't like certain things. I don't like garlic. I'm allergic to onion. Okay, so you have to be cognizant of that and spice accordingly. But that's kind of an obvious thing that, you know, you get used to very quickly. And if you really want to, just get on any search engine and search for, say, for example, Creole spice. You can make your own Creole spice at home rather inexpensively. And if you have some food allergies, it's really worth it to do that and to go through and make it so that you have a spice blend you can use that suits you very well. There's also a number of things called Grill Mates out there. Can't recall who makes them. Probably McCormick Spice, but I'm not sure. There's a couple different spice companies that make these that are pre-mixed grilling spices, usually intended for meats. Like, say, Montreal steak, for example, is intended for beef. Experiment with crossing these spices over into other things. Some of the like the mesquite spices, for example, work really well with red skin potatoes. You know, so there's no sense in when you're camping out not eating well too. Sitting down with friends on the beach, a beautiful night, relaxing and having a really good meal that you cooked yourself over a campfire is incredibly rewarding. And should you ever find yourself in a situation where, say, the power's out for a couple of weeks because of a storm, you can go outside, set up a grill, or even for that matter, if you had to, dig a hole in the ground, find some wood. Obviously, if you're going to use wood, there's a couple things to be really aware of in wood. If you're using bagged charcoal, this isn't an issue. But assuming that this is a survival situation where you don't have that option, do not, under any circumstance, use pressure-treated woods. The kind of greenish or sometimes even orangish-colored woods that are used for outdoors, because they have metal salts in them that will not be healthy to have in your foodstuffs. Now, that said, you should also be very cognizant of not using any kind of poisonous or toxic woods. Say, poison sumac, for example. Any kind of wood that is known to be poisonous, poison oak, so on and so forth. Only use woods that you know what they are, and it behooves you to learn a little bit about wood if you're gonna be in a camping situation. Most people are using hardwoods because they burn slower. They typically produce more heat by weight, or more heat by volume, I should say. But you can certainly use pine. You can certainly use fir. There are a number of different woods out there that you could easily use. You often see people down south using mesquite as a smoking flavoring agent, and that works great if you've got it. If you don't have it, that's okay too. Mesquite chips on a regular campfire or something like that can be real useful. We typically will mix them into a coal bed if we're going to use mesquite for a smoking effect when we're grilling right directly on the fire. Now, I don't know that you necessarily want to get mesquite in direct contact with the food. It's kind of a slightly oily, kind of nasty wood in that respect. Almost tarry in a way. So I'm not sure that I would necessarily do that, but you could probably do pre-burn the mesquite some and get it charred down a little bit, and then just lay coals on top of it so it's down in the bed and releasing smoke up through the bed, and that might give you the flavor as well. You'll have to experiment. Like anything else with this, you're going to have to do some experimentation. So, we've covered the basics of you know, basically digging a hole in the ground and setting up a fire. You should probably learn how to build a fire with very minimal equipment. There are a dozen good fire-making videos on YouTube easily. There's probably a couple thousand, but there's a dozen really good ones. And almost always they use some sort of a tinder or a char cloth, something like that. You can use paper until you get used to it if you don't have access to that sort of thing. And learning to make char cloth isn't that difficult. And we'll probably cover that in another episode at some point, because it's handy to have. Even if you're not actually trying to strike a fire with flint and steel, it does light a lot easier than a lot of other things. If you're out in the woods, if you happen to get lost in the woods, dry pine needles are extremely easy to get lit, which is why it's so dangerous to not be careful with your fire in the woods. So let's cover fire safety a little bit, because we didn't do that early on. Obviously, you want to have a pretty good-sized clear area around your fire. Even if you're using a charcoal grill, a hibachi, something like that, you want to have a pretty good clear area around it. 10 to 15 feet is not a bad idea at all. Just rake back anything loose like leaves, pine needles, brush, anything like that. If you got grass, that's not really an issue. Grass is difficult to catch fire unless it's quite dry. If it's quite dry, you might wet it down first. If you don't have the option of wetting it down because you don't have water, find a spot that doesn't have any grass. A creek shoal, a sandy spot, something like that. If it comes to it, dig down into the ground and build an earth berm up with the dirt and set your heat source down in the hole in the ground. Because really, you know, going from bad to worse is a textbook example of having something like a small campfire turn into a brush fire. Particularly if you're out west, you know how terrible the wildfires out there can be. You know, don't be the person that starts one of those. That's just not cool. That's not the Ranger way. And that's not survival of the smartest either, which is our Ranger motto. You really want to have some sort of method of putting the fire out handy. Be that a couple of buckets of water, a couple of buckets of sand, something like that. Just in case a wind comes up, if a sudden storm comes in and a wind comes up that you didn't realize was coming, that can be a real bad issue. Or if you get a spark gets caught by wind and carried off into dry leaves that you've raked up or something like that, you want to be able to put that out. And somebody should always be within line of sight of the fire at all times. It doesn't really matter if you're right next to it. You can be 20, 30 feet away without any problems whatsoever. But somebody should always be able to see it and should be keeping an eye on it. Fire doubles its size every minute. So, you know, in an uncontrolled environment. And so, you know, in a very short period of time, you often see grass fires where people say, oh, well, you know, we were burning leaves and we were only gone a few minutes. I can tell you by the size you were gone more than a few minutes. You know, you can tell by the size you were gone 20 or 30 minutes. And that's something of an issue. So, you know, be very smart about this stuff. Fire is dangerous. It's one of the things that basically allowed civilization to happen, but is also, even to this day, something that's incredibly threatening. Like most natural forces, it can be very dangerous. Common sense and knowledge is a good thing when you're dealing with something like fire, particularly if you live in an apartment and don't get a lot of experience to go out and have a campfire, that kind of stuff. It's really a good idea to go out with some friends and know what they're doing and have them show you the ropes. Obviously, you want to see what's above you. If you've got trees overhanging only 10 feet above, that's not the place to build a campfire at. 30, 40, 50, 60 feet is not a bad choice. Having a completely open sky is your best choice. Sometimes you don't have that option. You've got a campsite, for example, in the woods where the trees are all around you. A lot of state parks are set up like this. The camp pits, the campfire pits will be out toward the front. And usually the trees are trimmed back pretty good. It's not usually an issue. In the fall, when the leaves are dry, it can be an issue. You really got to watch sparks and that sort of stuff. When you add more wood to the fire, quite often it'll stir up sparks that'll rise up in the heat column. Part of the way to deal with that is, one, don't have a white man fire. Now, what is a white man fire? A white man fire is a huge, raging inferno nobody can get near that you can see from space. Why do they call them white man fires? Because back in the settler days, the Indians tend to keep their fires very small, up against some sort of windbreak like a rock or something like that. Just enough fire to cook their food and warm themselves. Whereas the white men would build huge bonfires so they could see further out into the plains at night to see if there's anybody out there. And so that's kind of where the term white man fire came from. Nowadays it's usually, and I'll tell you what, if you go down to any big campground, you know, Thousand Space campground, you will see a white man fire. It's the guys that have got 36 pallets stacked up, a can of gasoline, and a road flare in their hand that are going to be having a white man fire and probably no body here in about 15 minutes. All a white man fire does is make it too hot to get anywhere near, so you can't really cook with it. It makes it really, really difficult to control. It goes through fuel incredibly fast. If you've just got a small fire pit, say 3 feet in diameter, a single down tree cut up and dried can last you a couple of weeks, no problems, with just, you know, a small, reasonable campfire. And you burn your campfire for, maybe an hour, hour and a half, and you'll get a nice bed of coals. You rake off to one, about half the coals off to one side, and lay wood in on the opposite side. You'll have a really nice cooking area. You'll have some light, you'll have some heat. To some extent, it'll help keep the bugs back. Now, there's some things you can do to keep the bugs back even further, but this may or may not be palatable to you and your guests, your friends, your family. You can lay wet leaves or pine branches, that sort of stuff, onto the fire and create smoke. This will drive your neighbors nuts if you do it in town. You really don't want to do this. You'll probably have the fire department show up and cause all kinds of problems. What you're doing is putting a particulate in the air, because insects breathe through their body. That particulate basically makes it unpleasant for them to be around. It also makes it unpleasant for you to be around. Because your body creates a draft column, creates a vortex around it, it will act like the wind will always be shifting to bring the smoke to you. What's happening is you're creating kind of a drag vortex, almost like an aircraft wing or something like that. And the smoke has lift from the heat and finds places to go. Well, where you're standing at, if the wind is at your back, quite often there's a kind of a hollow in front of you that gets drawn right up, straight into your face, right up through. So it will seem like the fire is following you. In some ways, it actually is. If you get online and do some looking and searching, there's quite a bit of explanation on particularly when you start looking at wind turbines, you find out a lot about this sort of drag effect and the turbulence effects created by bodies and stuff. But that explains why the smoke does tend to follow you. There's ways around it. Getting low helps a great deal. Crouching down, or even sitting down in a low chair, that sort of thing. Sitting down on a log. The lower you are, the less drag you create in the air, so that helps a lot. Now, by being low, you also don't need anywhere near as big a fire. If your fire pit has really high sidewalls, like a lot of camping fire pits do, in a professional campground, a commercial campground, often you end up having to be up in the air further just simply because there's not a lot of heat and light being radiated out until you're up a couple of feet off the ground. So if you have the option to build your own fire pit, setting it down in the ground and having the stones or what have you around the upper edge only be a few inches up above the ground helps a great deal. You get more direct infrared radiation. The infrared's actually what's heating you up, not so much the heat from the fire as the infrared light coming off the fire. While I'm on it, the stones you use, never get stones out of a river or stones out of a lake, because they will have water in them, and if you heat them, they will split. Sometimes they split explosively. You can have a stone pop and throw hot, hard pieces of stone at you with considerable force. I'm not aware of anyone being severely injured, but I am aware of people being, you know, hit by hot stone, being burned, being cut slightly, that kind of thing. I'm aware of one case where some folks camping down the way from us insisted that the stones in the river were just fine and they were nice and round, so they had to use them. And the stones exploded and took out a window. So that gives you a little bit of idea how much force is involved. Took the window out of the side of a Jeep. So that tells you quite a bit about how much force involved there. With all that said, we've got some fire safety covered. We've got a basic thing. Now let's start talking about the more advanced stuff. Let's say you've gone out and done some yard sailing and found some nice cast iron cookware. But it's a mess. Absolute disaster area. No big deal. We can fix that. Cast iron is a wonderful media to cook in. Most people nowadays seem to have problems with it because they don't know a few little tricks. The first trick is clean it out really well. Steel wool, you know, if you really want to get after it, I don't have any problem whatsoever about taking a angle grinder with a wire wheel attachment and just chewing the inside out of it down to bare metal. And a lot of people out there are going to freak out about that. We'll cover that in a minute. We'll come back to that. Another trick, if you're knowledgeable about using these chemicals, is you can use muriatic acid to clean cast iron pans really easily. If you've not used muriatic acid before, don't. It's not particularly dangerous. It's not even as acids go, it's a very weak acid. Instead, use white vinegar. White vinegar is acetic acid. It will. You don't have anywhere near as much monkeying around trying to clean it and that kind of stuff when you're done. And disposing of it's nowhere near as much of a pain in the butt as muriatic or hydrochloric acid is. You basically wire brush the snot out of it. You put the acid into it. Let's say you're using white vinegar. You leave it set for, maybe an hour and a half. You might see some bubbles, you might not. You pour that out into a bowl. You're going to use it again. You wire brush the inside of your pan again, pour the vinegar back in, let it set for another hour or so, until basically you're down to bare metal. It works very effectively at stripping down the composites, the carbon buildup, and any old food or rust or anything like that might be the inside of the pan. You want to strip it back to bare metal. Now, at this point, if you try and cook in it, I don't care what you cook, it's going to stick. The surface of that pan is very porous. It very likely is going to just cause everything to stick to it like it was glued in the pan. And that just sucks. You don't want that. So the next step is to make it more non-stick. This is your great-granny's way of having non-stick cookware. I can speak English, I swear. Every episode I do that, I screw something up. It's a trademark now. You're going to take this pan that you've cleaned out. You're going to spread some oil on the inside of it. And what oil you use is very subjective. Everybody that I've talked to seems to have a different preferential oil. Most people use some kind of vegetable oil, canola, corn oil, something like that. My family always used to use lard. But I know that we had to re-season more often. You're gonna basically rub the pan down with something oil-based. And I don't mean motor oil, a cooking oil, something you can actually eat. Rub it down good, warm the pan slightly, and let it soak in. And by warm the pan, I mean you can set it in a hot, sunny window. You can put it in an oven, something like that. You're going to get the oil soaked into it, and then you're going to actually heat the pan up substantially and season it. Now, at this point, you're going to need some sort of a catch tray. I usually use a cookie sheet, or actually, what is it? It's got a rim on it. I don't know if it's exactly a cookie sheet or not. With a little steel cooling rack set into it, the pan set upside down, and I put it in the oven and turn the oven on for a couple hours. And it will smoke a little bit. I think I'm seasoning at 450, but I can't recall exactly. You'll have to do some searching online for that one. How to season cast iron is specifically what you're searching for. And it will give you step-by-step instructions. For that matter, I think there's probably a couple up on YouTube on how to do this. You can also do it with a couple other... There's other ways you can do it. You can do it with a torch. I don't suggest that. It's hard to get it evenly heated. You can do it on a campfire. What you're trying to do is create a carbon layer, a black, hard carbon layer on the inside of the pan. Quite often, you'll season it more than once. You'll season it three or four times before you actually cook in it. And this will help it be more nonstick. It'll make it easier to clean. When you're cooking, you're really better off to not use metal utensils, because metal utensils will scratch that carburized surface on the inside. And you have little black carbon flakes in your food, and people will freak out. If you make eggs in the pan, for example, use a wooden spatula. But now that you've got your cast iron seasoned, try and take pretty good care of it. Make it a canvas bag or something like that to carry it with the camp. That way you're not scraping the inside of it inadvertently. A lot of people will pile stuff, particularly metal stuff, into their cast iron. They get where they're going, and their food ends with a whole lot of little black flakes in there, and that's why. Well-seasoned cast iron is really a joy to cook on. It's not hard to take care of. It's not hard to maintain. When you're done, doesn't matter what you've cooked, put water in the pan and let it set for 20 minutes or so to loosen things up. Scrub it out carefully, turn it over and let it dry. That's all you got to do to it. You can certainly use soap and water, that sort of thing, but don't put it in the dishwasher or anything like that. And it works better if you don't cook or don't clean it with hot water. Just clean it with warm or even cold water, and clean it right after you cook in it. So when you finish up the meal, when you get done cooking and serve everything up, put water in at that point. When you finish up the meal, go ahead and take care of the pan right away, and it will last you for ages. So now we've got the pan seasoned, and that works for pretty much all cast ironware, griddles and so on and so forth. Now that we got the pan seasoned, we're going to take a little break. We're going to do a track from a buddy of mine who goes by Groove Digla. This is One Step, and you can find them on Reverb Nation. I believe it's Reverb Nation Groove Digla, so check them out. Thanks, guys. Thanks for letting me use that. These guys and my buddy Andy Samford, who has a track coming up here at the end, both have their stuff up online for free. Groove stuff you can find at Reverb Nation. Andy's stuff you can find at Electric Minnow Music. That's electricminnow.com or electricminnowmusic.com. I'm sorry. You know, I'm not sure. It might be electricminnow.com. You'll have to do some looking. Either way. Okay, in the first half, we covered getting your campfire set up, some basic safety tips. We covered getting your cast iron set up and seasoned. Now it's time to actually cook something in your cast iron. So, what do you make? Well, what don't you make? If you do a little bit of digging around on the net, you'll find out there's people out there that are cooking in cast iron that can cook just about anything. And I really do mean just about anything. I have had some fantastic meals from all different genres done in cast iron. Things like cake can be done in a cast iron pan. I had an absolutely wonderful Angel Food birthday cake made in cast iron, made in a big cast iron Dutch oven. Cooked on a campfire of coals, done out in the woods, and you know, made with. But we, you know, we carried everything in, obviously, but it had some frosting that was made with berries that were actually found right on the campsite. So we had angel food cake with homemade frosting that was, I think, raspberry, if I'm not mistaken. And if you know what is and isn't edible, you can certainly round up stuff from around your campsite and use that. Things like mint and so on and so forth are pretty common around a lot of different areas. If you don't know what's edible and what's not edible, don't just start grabbing things and throwing it in there. Find somebody who knows what they're doing to teach you. This is something you really kind of need to learn in the field. It doesn't hurt to have a book. You know, find yourself a good you know, food identification book. I know that in the UK there's the Collings Gem Food for Free, which is a fantastic little book that shows you what is and isn't edible, what parts, so on and so forth. And I don't know if there's one for the States or not. I have not seen one, but there might be one out there I'm not aware of. So you have some research and some homework to do there. Now, let's cover a few meals. You know, like I said at the beginning, if you're going to be in this situation, it really is a good idea to practice ahead of time. And not necessarily even in a camping situation, your own backyard, where if things really do go completely wrong and you make nothing more than charcoal in a pan, you can go get something else to eat without any difficulty. Let's start with breakfast. Any southern restaurant, truck stop, anything like that, the thing we've always used as a scale to know whether or not the place was good for anything else to eat anywhere else later or eat there later was biscuits and gravy. If a place can't make biscuits and gravy, they probably can't make anything else worth beans either. That rule of thumb may or may not be correct, but so far it has proved to be pretty accurate for my tastes. And sausage gravy is something that's really easy to make over a campfire cookout situation. So let's cover sausage gravy, huh? Now, for the biscuits themselves, you can use whatever you've got. I mean, if you're not really feeling gung-ho enough to go ahead and make the biscuits using a campfire at first, that's okay. If you want to use some of the biscuits in a tube sort of thing and cook them in the cast iron, that works too. Either way. But let's assume you've already got your biscuits set up and you're ready to go. So, at that point, you need some sausage. For this makes a pretty small, you know, serves maybe four people. Two if you're my friends, because we can eat this stuff. You'll need about a pound of breakfast sausage. And for those in the UK, breakfast sausage is a pork-based, usually, slightly spiced bulk sausage. It isn't really in casings or anything like that. Here in the States, there's a bunch of different name brands. Say, for example, Bob Evans is a name brand that comes up a lot. Jimmy Dean, things like that. They're all a pretty good basis. If you like one of those, use that. Otherwise, just find the house brand. You know, save yourself a little bit of money and experiment, because you're going to be doing a little bit more to it to give it some life. You'll need about a quarter cup of all-purpose flour. You can substitute cornmeal for this. It'll be a little drier, but it's a little richer, too. You'll need about 2 cups of milk. I've also done it with half and half, which makes a really thick, rich, real impressive, real good sausage gravy. And at that point, you know, if you're using the house brand stuff, you might want to add a little more kick to it. Usually salt and pepper, or you can go back to that Creole spice again that I suggested earlier on. You're going to crumble up and cook your sausage in your cast iron. You want to cook it over, you know, not real ragingly warm coals. You want to do this over a fairly good period of time, say 10, 15 minutes or so. There's going to be a lot of grease in the pan at this point. That's good. Don't dump that off. Don't be afraid of that. You're going to stir the flour into that grease in the pan from the gravy or from the sausage drippings. And once that's all mixed in and completely dissolved, you're going to add your milk. You're going to add your seasonings, whatever particular seasoning you want to add to it. And you're going to cook this until it's real thick and bubbly. You're kind of cooking down the milk, and you're mixing it all together. You just keep stirring it so it doesn't scorch. And you should have a really, really incredibly tasty sausage gravy. Very basic, very simple. Anybody should be able to do this. It's probably not real healthy for you. It's probably, let's see. A search says it's 700 calories, 44 grams of fat, and 71 milligrams of cholesterol. So it's not particularly healthy. But when you're out and running around in the field, particularly if you've got a really active day planned, a good breakfast is really important. So, you know, don't be terribly afraid of high-calorie stuff if you're active. Obviously, if you're making sausage gravy and sitting on the couch and eating it, that's gonna land in places. You're going to have issues with that. On the other hand, if you're out kayaking whitewater, starting a day with sausage gravy and eggs, not a bad way to go at all. Now, obviously, if you got vegetarians in your group, you'll have to adjust your recipe some. This is going from a meat eater's diet, so on to lunch. One of the things that we've made a number of times, heck, we make this at home when we're not even camping. I don't have a name for it. I don't even know what to really call it. Disassembled meatloaf, maybe? It's all the components of meatloaf that haven't been made into a loaf and baked. You're going to use your pan that you cleaned out good after breakfast, I hope. Say a pound and a half of hamburger. You brown it up. You don't strain the grease out of it again. Again, it's probably horrible for you. Usually we dice up onions. Occasionally, if we're trying to stretch it a little bit, we'll even go so far as to adding, say, 20 or 30 tater tots into it, just crushed up and cooked into it. Once everything is browned up, you start adding your other stuff. And this is where it's going to get weird. You're going to sit and stare at the radio and look at me and go, okay, there's something wrong with you here. In a pound and a half of hamburger, you know, in the grease, everything still together, in cast iron, you're going to shred up 2 to 3 pieces of bread. The richer bread is better. Pumpernickel does not seem to work for beans, but whole grain breads, wheat bread, that kind of stuff, works great. You're just going to tear it up in little pieces and drop it in. That's all you're going to do to it. Now, I know, it doesn't look terribly appetizing at this point. You're just going to crumble the bread into it. If you got a lid, it doesn't hurt to put a lid on and let it steam a little bit. What you're trying to do is fry the bread in the grease here. No, it's not healthy at all, but boy, is it ever tasty. You're trying to basically make a meatloaf that isn't a meatloaf. Think of it as meatloaf that's been crushed and just fell apart and, you know, made completely wrong, but that's what it is. It's all the components of meatloaf without being an actual loaf. Now, typically, I always cheated and used French onion soup mix, too, when I made meatloaf. It was a lazy way of doing it, but, you know, if you don't like onion, obviously you don't want that in there. The onions go in pretty early when the hamburger is still fairly raw, with the idea that you're gonna caramelize the onions. It makes them a little sweeter, it makes them much softer, makes them more palatable to most people. If you got big hunks of raw onion in there, you're going to hear about it. You know, sitting around the campfire, people are going to flick stuff at you. So, you know, cook it down good, stir it up occasionally, you know, turn everything over occasionally. If you want to add a little bit of a ketchup on top of it when you get done, set it off to the side and let it cool. Squirt some ketchup on the top of it, and you've instantly got disassembled meatloaf. I don't know what else to call it. It probably has a name, but that's the only thing I know it of. Taking the same basic concept, you can make kind of a... it's not exactly chili. It's sort of a chili meatloaf kind of hybrid thing. You basically make the same thing again, only you're adding about 2 cans of baked beans and some sort of a tomato-based sauce. You want to put some chili sauce in there to give a little bit of kick, you know, whatever you like. And by baked beans, I'm talking, you know, baked beans. I don't mean like navy beans or something like that. Regular, I don't know what baked beans actually are. I need to look that up. I don't know what kind of bean they are. But a couple of big cans of baked beans, some chili sauce. When you get it done, put some shredded cheddar on top of it. If you want to, go ahead and add the bread into that also. You get kind of an interesting hybrid. It's not a real wet chili. It's a very dry chili, but it's pretty good. If you want to make it really interesting, add that all together, and instead of using hamburger, use corned beef instead. Canned corned beef works just fine for this. Absolutely perfect for this. A can of corned beef, even corned beef hash will work. It's not as good. It still works. It's a little weird because you got the potato mixed into it. The potato tends to boil down and cook down and almost just like a sludge. So you get kind of a gravy effect mixed into it. And you can also put in hot dogs if you want to. The little tiny Vienna sausages work really well in this. Here's a big family secret. I probably shouldn't give this one away, but I'm gonna. You take a big cast iron Dutch oven, well seasoned. You put Vienna sausages into it, all of them, as many as you can get your hands on, up to the point that it's, you know, just about full. And you cook them for a great deal of time in a weird sauce. And when I tell you the sauce, you're going to sit there and stare at this thing and go, that sounds disgusting. It cooks down to a brown sludge that it doesn't look terribly edible. And I'll tell you, most of this stuff looks kind of scary when you first see it. It's all pretty tasty. It just kind of looks a little rough. You're going to make the sauce out of equal parts of grape jelly and mustard. Yep, sounds disgusting. You know what? It's actually really incredibly good. You can do this in a crock pot. Most of the stuff you can pull off in a crock pot, too, but this particular one works really well in a crock pot. This has been a kind of a secret family recipe for a very long time, and I probably shouldn't share it, but there it is. It's in the show. So there's one of the secret family recipes. For dinner, you know, let's make gumbo. I like southern food, so let's make gumbo. You're going to need another pretty good size, like a Dutch oven for this. Like a 2-quart Dutch oven would be perfect for this. You're going to want some chicken, say a pound of chicken. Canned chicken works fine. Some sausage, say kielbasa, half pound of kielbasa sausage. A tablespoon or two of butter. Some Creole seasoning. A couple cups of water to get it a little bit, spread out and that kind of stuff. And you're going to probably want to add some sort of rice or rice and bean mix base to it, you know, like a dirty rice kind of mix or something like that. In this case, you're going to need to get this almost to a boil to really get it to blend the flavors effectively well. And I'll tell you what, this is one of those ones that if you cook it and let it set overnight, it actually gets better with age. The screwed up chili does too. It seems to actually blend the flavors together a little bit, and you get kind of a more rich, you know, kind of great flavor. So, obviously, when you're camping, you need to store your food someplace that raccoons and bears and whatnot, other campers, won't get into it. We typically hang our stuff. We throw a rope over a tree branch and raise it up in a basket or a bag or something like that. And so you're going to need some sort of a container. Having some plastic containers with you is not a bad idea when you're camping out. Obviously, if you're making this in a rough situation, you know, no power situation, you'll probably eat it all that day. But if you're just camping, that kind of stuff, doing some experimentation, you have enough. If you have leftovers, half this stuff there won't be leftovers. Half this stuff they'll be standing there staring at the pot, going, "There's no more left." Because it's kind of a rich, unusual food that you don't run into at restaurants very often. You don't run into it at cookouts very often. And people will just go after it in ways you don't imagine. So hopefully this has given you some ideas. Hopefully you'll be able to take some of this and do some research on your own and come up with more recipes on your own. Try them out. absolutely feel free to jump on Facebook and give us a like. You leave your recipes, whatever. We'll give you credit and put them in future episodes. We'll have a couple more cookout episodes a year. This one's kind of aimed for Memorial Day, and we'll air the week before, I think, on Rant Radio, which is rantradio.ca. If you get a chance, stop in there. Check out the other neat media. If you got a few bucks extra and can, click on the Donate tab and help Sim keep the radio station going. Hop on IRC at irc.freeno.net. The channel is #r4nger5. Come in and see us. Or find us at rangers.com. That's r4nger5.com. From here, we're going into Andy Samford's cover of Bonnie Tyler's song Total Eclipse of the Heart, which you can find at electricminnowmusic.com. Thank you much for listening. Have a great day. Hope you come back again. Here comes Andy.
Listen to the sound. always in the dark. We're living in a powder keg and giving off sparks. I really need you tonight. Forever's gonna start tonight. Forever's gonna start tonight. Dark.